It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of people of Latino descent make a life in Wisconsin. We explore connections between faith, hospitality, and social justice movements in Latino communities through the decades and those implications today. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. New book is called Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. Sergio, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Your family immigrates from Jalisco, Mexico, to the U.S. before you are born. And this book, you start researching Latino history in a library. Can you tell us what happens when you open those boxes of archives?
Yeah, you know, like any young graduate student, I had grand ambitions to go into the archives and kind of uncover the history that was central to my dissertation when I was in grad school. And for me, the topic I was most interested in was really discovering the history of Latinos in the state of Wisconsin. I went to the archives for the first trip and, you know, with great ambitions and asked the archivist to bring me everything that they had preserved on the history of this community that I thought was going to take up the next few years of my life to study. He came back with three boxes and told me that was all that they had. It was pretty disheartening at first, but I opened that first box and the very first document that I pulled out was a newspaper insert from 1987 from the Milwaukee Journal. And on the front cover of that newspaper article was a picture of my family and me, just a few months old in my parents' arms, walking out of a Southside church here in Milwaukee. And I got to thinking as I looked at that image, what did it mean that the Milwaukee Journal had featured this Latino family walking out of a church on a bright Sunday morning, happy, in fellowship and community, and was kind of showcasing this image as distinctive, but also very indicative of the history and the story of Latinos in Milwaukee and across the state of Wisconsin.
In that moment, you must have had so many emotions going through you and so many questions.
No, absolutely. It's that existential moment that I think every historian, every scholar is looking for when they ask themselves, you know, why am I studying what I study? And here I was on my first trip to the archives, literally finding myself within my research. And so it was very stupefying, kind of that first experience. And then I had to kind of quickly put on my historian's hat and get to work and kind of untangle all of the things that this document could tell us about the present, about Latinos in Wisconsin in 1987 and the past. What was the history that this image could kind of unveil for us?
You must have had so many gaps to fill, you know, to tell a story of a community whose history, you know, resides in several boxes at that archive. But you also said it's a history that's been ignored. So how do you begin to tell the story?
Yeah, you know, for me, the kernel, the nugget of this project is really seeking to understand why it is that even though Latinos have existed, have occupied, have lived in spaces across the state of Wisconsin, they're often still referred to as newcomers, as foreigners, as aliens, as people who don't fully belong in the state. And I think this introduction story about the archives is kind of just one way of digging into that, right? If we don't think these people are permanent residents of the state, if we don't think that they deserve to belong in the state, why should we preserve their history? And so my research, both in this book and in other endeavors that I have as a public historian, are really trying to understand why is it that Latinos have come to Wisconsin? Why haven't we done a good job of saving that history? And then I think most importantly, what do we have to do moving forward to make sure that we can do a better job of archiving those histories, of preserving them, of celebrating them, so that we can better understand this past as well.
Sergio Gonzalez with us, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer, as we talk about the history of Latinos in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Sergio, let's step back for a moment, go back a century, talk about the migration of Latinos to Wisconsin throughout the early 1900s. Can you talk about which Latinos are migrating to Wisconsin, what it is like, and why they are coming?
Yeah, so the first Latinos that we can recognize is really settling here in Wisconsin, stretched back to the late 19th century. But the first sizable communities that we can kind of see developing, especially here in Milwaukee, begin in the early 1920s, and they're recruited here to the city by the city's growing factories, foundries, and tanneries to serve kind of as the next group of cheap, pliable labor. They're really following, and unfortunately, in the footsteps of a lot of different immigrants who had come before them, who had kind of filled these really difficult positions, working in backbreaking labor that often did not compensate them well. And kind of to complicate that, to make it even worse, when they were recruited from Mexico in the early 1920s, they were often brought as strike breakers to break the heavily unionized workforce here in Milwaukee. And they were brought, of course, under false pretenses. They didn't know that that's why they were coming here. So their first interactions with the city are some pretty rough ones, right? They have some pretty awful experiences at the work site and social spaces. They're not really accepted as Milwaukeeans, as Wisconsinites, when they first arrive. And as I detail in the early sections of the book, those early Mexican immigrants who come to Wisconsin find fellowship, find a sense of sanctuary, a sense of belonging in their churches. And it's also one of the only places that they develop any sort of community with the city's white European American residents. It's that shared sense of Catholicism, a shared sense of faith that allows them to create bridges of fellowship. And they're often tenuous bridges, right? They're not the strongest connections because they don't always extend beyond the confines of the church, the pews in which they're praying together. But there's something. It's something to look into and to try to understand how can this faith serve as a bridge between these communities that may have otherwise seen themselves as enemies or antagonists.
I was struck by how these early immigrants were at sometimes living on factory floors in Milwaukee, and the living conditions were so poor and not being able to find housing. But at the same token, you are trying to build out the story of how churches were sometimes a place of refuge, sometimes filling those gaps. But can you talk a bit about these living conditions at the time?
Yeah, they are shuttled into Walker's Point, which the historian, Milwaukee historian John Goethe, has often referred to as Walker's Point as kind of the Ellis Island of Milwaukee. It's the entry point for a lot of immigrants who arrive in the city throughout the 19th and 20th century. It's one of the city's oldest neighborhoods. And it's also the place that was a hub for this factory, tannery, and foundry work that these Mexican immigrants are being brought to engage in the early 1920s. And so this is the only neighborhood that they can really live in for a number of different reasons. I mean, one, it's right next to their work sites. The housing there is in pretty rough shape. It's the only place they can rent. And often what happens is these Mexican migrants will show up, and they might get a house. And then while the men are engaged in this hard physical labor, the women are also engaged in labor. And that's in the labor of kind of constructing these apartments, these settlement places where incoming Mexican immigrants can settle and find a place to lay their head. Because otherwise, as you note, some of them are forced to live within the factory walls, especially those initial immigrants who are afraid that if they leave the factory walls, they're going to get their heads bashed in by these Milwaukee workers who are quite upset with them because they're seen as strike breakers, as scabs. And so their assimilation experiences are really tenuous here. The other thing that I'll note that I talk about in the book is that a lot of the social agencies that are ostensibly in place to help them integrate into the community, the immigrant settlement houses here in Milwaukee, see them not only as foreigners, as alien, but as racial others. And so drawing from eugenics and this kind of this pseudo-racial science, they perceive these Mexicans as not being fully capable of integration because of some racial deficits. And so they have a really rough go of it outside of churches, finding a place where they can belong in the city of Milwaukee.
Talking with author and historian Sergio Gonzalez. The book is Strangers No Longer, as we explore the intersections here of migration, fellowship, activism, and churches. Call in with a question. You can add your reflections. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the Latino community and its faith practices in Wisconsin, drawing upon migration, labor, the religious history. Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez probes the question, why are Latinos still viewed by many Wisconsinites as newcomers? Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Strangers No Longer. Sergio, you write about a time of hostility toward Latinos in Milwaukee, but Mexicans do find some common ground with fellow Catholics. What was that relationship like between the newly arriving immigrants and the Catholic Church, and were there Spanish-speaking priests at the time?
Yeah, you know, it was it's a really interesting inflection point for Mexicans when they arrive here, because it takes them a while to really find a home in the Catholic Archdiocese here in Milwaukee. And it's really because of the initiative of some local Catholics just kind of at their local parish, at the Holy Trinity Church in the Walker's Point neighborhood. It kind of speaks to the importance of individual agency, of individual actors, of kind of taking that step to reach out to persons who may be different from them, who they may not recognize, but perhaps they see that they need some sort of assistance. And so there's this individual here at the Holy Trinity Church. His name is Frank Gross. And he is a loyal member of the congregation. He speaks Spanish because he's an accountant who works in Mexico sometimes. And he takes the personal initiative to rally the Holy Trinity Parish to help these arriving Mexican Catholics in the city of Milwaukee. And he takes it upon himself to reach out to the archdiocese and to work with the archbishop here in the city. And to the archdiocese credit, they commit funds to purchase a building on the city's south side where Mexicans can practice their faith. It's a mission chapel that they choose for themselves because they want to be able to practice their form of Catholicism in a way that's comfortable to them, that reminds them of home. And then, of course, they have to go through that arduous work of finding a priest who can actually speak Spanish, because this is a problem that exists all across the Midwest as Mexicans are arriving in places like Chicago, Detroit, and the Twin Cities. There aren't any Spanish-speaking priests who can really serve them. And so this is all happening in the midst of a very traumatic revolutionary war in Mexico. The Mexican state is coming down pretty hard on the Catholic Church. And so there are actually Mexican Catholic refugee priests all across the United States. And so this early mission chapel that they call Our Lady of Guadalupe Mexican Mission Chapel, they're able to recruit one of these refugee priest to come up to Milwaukee in 1926 and serve as the city's first Mexican pastor.
Does the church exist today?
Yeah, it certainly does. It's not in that original storefront building, although if you come down to Fifth and National, Walker's Point, you can certainly still see that building there. But the congregation has moved into the Holy Trinity Church, and Holy Trinity is one of the oldest Catholic churches in the city of Milwaukee. And it's a story that's replicated across, U.S. Northern Catholic churches all across the country. White flight in the 1950s and 1960s really brings down the white population, the white Catholic population on the city's south side. Holy Trinity Church is losing its kind of traditional parishioner base. But at the same time, the south side's Mexican and eventually Puerto Rican community and Catholic community is exploding. And so in the mid-1960s, the Mexican Mission Church migrates over to Holy Trinity and kind of takes it over. And to this day, Holy Trinity, Our Lady Guadalupe, is really the heart of Mexican Catholicism in Milwaukee, and I would argue really in the state of Wisconsin.
Sergio, you really dig deep into that Christian tenet of hospitality and study aspects of the hospitality at work here. How would you characterize at this point the extent of hospitality to these early arrivals of Latino immigrants in the 1900s?
You know, the reason I draw on this concept of hospitality is because I think it's something really, it's something that we all understand, whether we see it as a religious tenet or just something as a social value. And so when we look back into the early 20th century, we can kind of recognize the way in which communities do or do not welcome people, kind of see them at the threshold of a building or the threshold of a community, and make the decision to open their doors to them. And so the thing that's really interesting about the 1920s and 1930s is that early Mexican mission chapel really goes all out in all types of ways to be hospitable to Mexican Catholics. It does so in a religious sense by offering them a religious home, and one that is connected to the larger Milwaukee Catholic Archdiocese. But that religious home also serves as a social service agency, as an educational space, as a political space, as Mexican Catholics in Milwaukee can kind of research and keep an eye on what's happening in their home country in terms of persecution of the Catholic Church in the 1920s. And so for me, one of the prime examples of what we refer to as kind of a full sense of hospitality really does happen in the 1920s. And it perhaps is kind of alarming to think about that 100 years ago, the city had some of the best instances of outreach to Mexican immigrants. And perhaps there are things that we can certainly learn from those experiences today in the 21st century.
Sergio Gonzalez with us, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer, as we take a look at the deeper history of Latinos in Wisconsin. Call in with questions. You can share your perspective at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio, drawing to present moment here for a moment, in recent months, record numbers of migrants are attempting to cross the southern border. Are there parallels between the migrant experience and the hospitality you've been talking about a century ago versus what is happening today?
Oh, goodness. There certainly are. Some of them are startling. Some of them are perhaps fresh. But there are also distinctions that have to be made between these stories, right? I guess it's my job as a historian to kind of draw those parallels while also demarcating the things that are different. I think that the number one thing that we have to recognize is that the people who are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border today are arriving for many of the same reasons that Latino immigrants began to arrive in places like Milwaukee in the early 1920s. And really, quite honestly, that most people have come to this country, and that is to search for a better life for themselves and for their family. Now, a lot of those people who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border might or might not qualify for political asylum under U.S. and international human rights law. But the question of why they're coming, I think, is really important. And the second piece of that, of course, is what obligation the United States has to offer some sort of home, of solace, of sanctuary to these people. And that, of course, is one of the most active political conversations that we're having today. The thing that's interesting to me as a lifelong Wisconsinite, as someone who studies Latino communities here in the Midwest, of course, is how do we view this phenomenon that's happening 1,500 miles away at the U.S.-Mexico border is something that is important to us. And of course, I think we see this in different ways. We can see this in the way in which Latinos arrive in Wisconsin, not just in Milwaukee, not just in Madison, but really in all parts of our state. I think we just have to look at a place like Whitewater, which over the last 6 months, over the last year, has been grappling with this very question of hospitality and the also difficult question of how we can provide services to people who are really looking to make a life for themselves in this country. And these are not easy conversations. They're certainly not easy conversations when we only have them at the local level. And so that's why I think it's important for us to kind of blow the lens up and look at it from different stages, whether it's the local, the state, the federal, and of course the international as well. And to put it within that larger historical perspective.
I was trying to glean insights from your book about the operations of government in those moments that might inform what happens today. And you write about the Governor's Commission on Human Rights. And I'm just wondering, you found state commissions often working with employers, but seeing the migrants as more of like a problem to be solved. What were the dynamics there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a phenomenon of the post-World War II era, as a lot of local and state agencies are trying to grapple with the United States' obligation to live up to its stated ideals of democracy and citizenship. And so, of course, after soldiers return home from fighting overseas in World War II, there are a lot of Americans who kind of are rethinking how they can best exemplify those stated ideals, those progressive ideals of of democracy and citizenship. And so when Texas Mexican migrant farm workers began arriving in large numbers in Wisconsin in the 1940s and 1950s, they unfortunately experienced a lot of similar situations that Mexican immigrants had experienced in the 1920s here in Milwaukee. And now, of course, it's not just happening in urban spaces like Milwaukee, but it's happening in places like Wautoma, in Door County, in Waupun, all across the state. And these commissions, like the Governor's Commission on Human Rights, they see their work as twofold. One is to try to draw out the best in Wisconsinites to fulfill some sort of larger obligation to protect and preserve this concept of human rights. But there's also kind of the harder part, which is how do you get people to do that work? And the thing about those state agencies is that they really held no sort of power. And so there was no enforcement capacity to push Wisconsinites to treat Texas Mexican migrant farm workers as more than just laborers, to treat them as human beings, and perhaps also as constitutive members.
Let's pause there with Marquette University Assistant Professor of History, Sergio Gonzalez. Call in questions, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A book that centers Latinos in Wisconsin shows how immigrants mobilized through their religion and how churches can serve as agents of political change. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. Book is called Strangers No Longer. Sergio, we heard from Rachel sent along an email saying that they live in New London, Wisconsin, and there's a large Latino population in the city. Rachel says there are multiple businesses that are Latino-owned, including restaurants, and the city's only bakery features traditional sweets and breads. And Rachel enjoys the culture that they bring to the community, feels good to live in a place that is accepting and welcomes diversity. How do you feel about those sentiments?
I mean, that's exactly what we want Wisconsinites to understand, right? And I appreciate this message is coming in from New London, out of Gaymere, Wolpaca. You know, it's an area that perhaps Wisconsinites might not realize has a large Latino population. And in the book, what I'm trying to do is to show that these communities have existed in places like Outagamie and Waupaca for quite a long time. And perhaps they have been migrant farm workers occupying these spaces for a limited time, coming in the spring and leaving in the harvest season. Or perhaps they are now lifelong residents like they are all across urban and rural spaces in Wisconsin. And I think the important thing for our state residents to really grapple with is, what does it mean to be a good neighbor? What are the boundaries of being a good neighbor? In other words, do we just say hello to someone, or do we welcome them into our spaces and consider them full members of our communities? So I really appreciate that sentiment.
So taking us into that mid-20th century, migrant farm workers, you write, are among the most economically disadvantaged and socially alienated populations in the country. What is happening in this time in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, the state after World War II is a booming agricultural site. It is actually the number one canning state in the entire United States. So it's producing so much produce that is really feeding not just the country, but the world. But with such accelerating economic production, it needs workers to do the work. And the place that farmers look to fill these needs is the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and they look towards Texas Mexicans, American citizens who refer to themselves as Tejanos, to come up here every spring to help plant the produce and then to actually pick them all the way through the early fall. And so in the 1950s, about 15,000 Texas Mexicans are making their way to Wisconsin, and they come up as family units because if you can walk, if you can pick, the expectation is you're helping the family provide that really that important income that they need for the entire year. Unfortunately, even though they are essential to the state's agricultural industry, they are often perceived as nothing more than just workers. And so they have some really rough working conditions, rough pay conditions. And then when they try to move into social spaces, whether that's the local beaches, whether that's restaurants in towns across Wisconsin, they're often met with a cold shoulder.
And in the workforce housing, you then see Catholics and Protestants coming to the fields and talking to the migrant laborers. Can you explain the tensions there and what the religious groups are trying to do?
You know, this is a really awkward moment, I would say, for telling this history, because the Catholics and Protestants, what they refer to themselves as migrant ministers, they go out into the fields with the stated intention of serving these people who are functionally seen as outcasts in many of the communities that they inhabit. But oftentimes what that outreach turns into is less a form of full hospitality and instead competition over the attendance of these Mexican migrants in their churches. There's this one example here that I draw out in the book. The Wisconsin Council of Churches sends their migrant ministers out into the fields, and they send them out in a specific type of car. It's a station wagon that's equipped with everything they need to conduct, religious services out in the middle of a field. And these station wagons are emblazoned on the side with a word. It says the harvester. And of course, it's kind of a play on words. They are working with harvesters in the fields, but these migrant ministers are also serving as harvesters of souls. They're trying to make sure they can maybe get some converts to the Protestant faith. And so there's a real competition between Catholics and Protestants, not to better serve these migrants, but functionally to make sure that they become members of their churches.
And this is how you say this is a conditional type of hospitality. There is, you convert, and then we perhaps will give you further support. Was there support being given to these laborers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conditional hospitality that exists within these church spaces, right? I will offer you support. I will offer you welcome into the state if you convert to the faith or if you are a willing attending of church. But it's also a conditional hospitality that exists all across the state of Wisconsin outside of church spaces. It's, you know, we will welcome these migrants as long as they provide us some sort of economic service. And so this is a form of conditional hospitality because it's a form of welcome that's dependent on the economic utility that these individuals can offer to the state of Wisconsin. Through the 1950s, migrant farm workers really struggled to find a place in the state. And it's made extra difficult, of course, by the fact that they're only here from April through September or October. And then they have to migrate back to the U.S.-Mexico borderlands where they live in the off season. And so throughout the 1950s, they don't have a lot of resources to kind of create solid spaces in the state where they feel like they completely belong.
Sergio Gonzalez with us as we look at the history of Latinos in Wisconsin, 1900s, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Sergio, let's look now to Puerto Ricans who migrate to Wisconsin by the thousands after World War II. And you found churches received Puerto Ricans differently than they had Mexican migrants. How are the two groups treated differently?
Yeah, well, in some ways, they're treated very differently, even though they share, you know, linguistic background. And some of the churches do see them in a similar light to the Mexicans in that they are, you know, Latin American arrivals to the space. But Puerto Ricans begin arriving in Milwaukee. They're also recruited here as industrial laborers after World War II. And they find a very different reception than the Mexican Catholics had received before them. Puerto Rican Catholics have kind of shuttled into a very different form of hospitality. It's one that's based really around the question of assimilation. The Catholic Church as a national institution, right, archdioceses around the country are beginning to move away from this idea of allowing immigrants to retain their ethnic heritage and specifically their linguistic identity. And what they're trying to do is to really shuttle newcomers into a larger American Catholic Church. They want these people who are arriving in the United States to be kind of be perceived as full members of an American Catholicism. And so what that means for Puerto Ricans, who of course are American citizens when they arrive here, is that they are forced into English classes. Their use of Spanish priests is kind of seen as temporary so that they can be shuttled eventually into a larger parish structure. And so perhaps the intention is good in that the hope is that they will integrate into the community, but the reality is that they're being forced to do so at the extent or kind of at the loss of what they may hold to be dear to their identity as Puerto Ricans, as Puerto Rican Catholics.
Can you speak to how Frank Seidler, the mayor of Milwaukee in those years, serving three terms starting in 48, how did Seidler treat Puerto Ricans in Milwaukee?
Seidler views Puerto Ricans in the same way that many Milwaukeeans view Puerto Ricans, and that is as racial others, as strangers that kind of exist at the edges of the community, as in-migrants that have to be assimilated to the community, perhaps under ways that are not necessarily inviting, that again require them to give up something of themselves. And so, unfortunately, the archives don't paint the Seidler administration in a very positive light. They kind of talk about these cultural deficiencies that exist among Puerto Ricans, talk about kind of the limits to which they might be actually be able to be included into the larger American body. And in some ways, they kind of parrot a lot of what's happening in the city streets, in the northeast side, where a lot of Puerto Ricans are settling, and also in some of the city's Catholic and Protestant churches. And so, again, this is kind of a persistent issue throughout the 1950s, viewing these people as newcomers who may or may not be able to integrate into the community because of their language, because of their skin color, because of who they are.
Ellen in Cedarburg called in and is wondering if you could address the racism aspect in this conversation and what you learned in your research.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that's unfortunately a consistent thread when talking about Latino settlement in Wisconsin. And we can talk about racism. We can talk about colorism, right? The fact that a Latino skin color can also change the way in which they're viewed by Wisconsinites. And there's also, of course, the question of where Latinos fit within what I think is a very persistent binary all across the Midwest, which is a white-black racial binary. It's a way that we've kind of view the world within these two worlds. Historians of the Midwest often talk about Latinos in the Midwest as being in-between people because they arrive in the 1920s after a lot of Wisconsinites and Wisconsin institutions have established this kind of racial understanding of a black and white world, and Latinos don't fit neatly into that narrative. And I think we kind of see that to this day. We're still kind of troubling with that, whether that's in the US Census, whether that's in questions of affirmative action, whether that's in the way in which Latinos relate to different institutions. And of course, racism, which is the inaction kind of discrimination based on a person's perceived race, is also a part of that story.
Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez examining how Wisconsin Latinos have struggled with feelings of being strangers in their communities, not accepted. The book is called Strangers No Longer. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez, who shows how some Wisconsin churches became vocal advocates for the rights of Latino immigrants and refugees. And we trace this movement, especially in Milwaukee. You can join the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Larry in Kingston is here. Larry, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to ask you about the restaurants in Milwaukee. Last time I drove through Milwaukee, the Acapulco restaurant and the Cancun restaurant, I couldn't find either one. And they were so good in the late 70s, early 70s. I was wondering if you're familiar with them.
Larry, thank you. Can you speak about the longtime established businesses and what's become of them, Sergio?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Larry. Yeah, of course, those are great Southside institutions. Unfortunately, they have both closed up. The Acapulco, I remember that growing up, on, you know, right on off the National in Walker's Point. You know, it's the history of a lot of immigrant communities in Wisconsin. It's turning to food as a place of making home. It's a place to connect different communities that are thousands of miles removed from the places that they really miss. But it's also, of course, a way of inviting the local residents into your own culture. And so Mexican restaurants, Puerto Rican restaurants, and now Central American restaurants all across Milwaukee, across Wisconsin, can often serve as that gateway, as we can kind of see in this conversation, a way of connecting with this community. And the thing that I would hope is that those restaurants are kind of first steps and not just last steps for Wisconsinites to learn more about Latinos in the state.
Richard from Madison called and mentioned that they worked at the Green Giant Canning Company in Beaver Dam between 1974 and 75. And in that time, migrant workers came through as well. Richard says they weren't treated well as they lived in trailers, had to work different shifts. But my father made close friends, Richard says, with a worker and then their family. Can you talk about those connections at all as to what, that type of hospitality would bring?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment from Richard. You know, I think it really speaks to the distinctions between institutions, employers, and individuals, right? I mean, we have to kind of look at this at a lot of different levels. Even though migrant farm workers may have experienced really bad working conditions all across the 20th century and the agricultural industry, and perhaps they had antagonistic relationships with their bosses, that doesn't preclude them from making individual relationships with local Wisconsinites. And it really does speak to the importance of individual initiative, right? The agency we all have to begin to kind of disrupt these larger 100-long histories of these false senses of hospitality, that we can extend a welcoming hand to somebody and get to know someone as an individual, as someone we work with, as someone who can be a constitutive member of our communities. And so I'm really glad for that comment.
You write about a group of kids who called themselves the Thunderbirds. And in the 60s, they convert this tavern into a social hangout. It was the Spot. Can you tell us about that moment in history?
Yeah, this is, you know, the Spot is formed as a Protestant outreach center on the city south side of Milwaukee towards the city's growing Mexican and Mexican-American Puerto Rican youth, trying to get kids off the streets from doing dumb things and giving an outlet for them to do something more productive. But the kids, they take the initiative and transform this. They turn what used to be a street gang called the Thunderbirds into a productive social agency, which eventually becomes the Spot, which today is known with a very different name here in Milwaukee, the United Community Center. Mm-hmm. It is a central hub of Latino life on the city's south side. It really offers everything from prenatal care all the way to senior care. I mean, so it's amazing to think about how this institution that is central to Milwaukee's Latino community began both as a place of religious outreach, but also as a place of initiative by youth on the city's south side.
And in this time, El Centro Hispano is formed, the first nonprofit Latino organization. What is that milestone like?
Well, it's really important because it's a recognition by the Catholic Church here in Milwaukee that they have to move beyond just opening parish spaces for Latinos. And they're recognizing that on the city's south side, there's a growing need to provide educational services, work services, integration experiences for Latinos. And they really put the money where their mouth is. They make sure that there are actually resources available. And as I kind of track in the book, the history of Centro Hispano, which becomes a Spanish center, the United Community Center, and also United Migrant Opportunities Services, are stories of, you know, religious institutions creating these spaces, and then Latinos deciding that they have to actually take over these agencies to have full control of them, mm-hmm. For them to actually represent the needs of the community.
Take us into the sanctuary movement. Now we go into the 1980s, the movement seeking to provide refuge for Central American asylum seekers. How critical are religious organizations for that movement in that time?
I think listeners might be surprised to learn that Milwaukee was a central hub of sanctuary organizing in the 1980s. Churches and synagogues here in Milwaukee opened up their houses of worship as places of safe harbor for the hundreds of thousands of Central Americans who were fleeing persecution and civil war in their home countries. You know, these civil wars in places like Guatemala and El Salvador killed 250,000 people, forced the migration of more than 2 million others northward. And the United States government in the 1980s refused to recognize them as political asylees because they'd also have to recognize the military's role in destabilizing those countries. And so it was really churches and synagogues all across the United States that became places of asylum, temporary asylum for these people. Milwaukee had the first Latino, the first Black, and the first Jewish congregations that opened up their places as houses of sanctuary in the 1980s. I mean, it's kind of phenomenal to think that Milwaukee was such an important spot for this. And of course, sanctuary today in the 21st century is a really polarizing term. It's a politically fraught term. But in the 1980s, what it actually meant was extending a sense of hospitality to those who needed it most.
And at the pulpit, there are the testimonios that, Central Americans telling their stories to congregations, what they have experienced. Did that change public opinion on asylum seekers?
No, it certainly did. You know, the sanctuary movement had a lot of different angles. One was, of course, that humanitarian aid, but the other was really to alert Americans of our country's complicity in destabilizing nations down in Central America. And the primary purveyors of that educational work were really the Central Americans themselves, who would go to different churches all across Milwaukee and all across Wisconsin, actually, telling their heart-wrenching stories of violence, of persecution, of death. And really imploring Wisconsinites to step forward and to push their legislators to stop sending military aid to Central America, to recognize that they had an obligation not just to offer safe harbor to these people, but to try to fix the very conditions that were forcing them to leave from their home countries in the first place.
Further to these times, then, there's the new sanctuary movement. What occurred when former President Trump was elected?
You know, the new sanctuary movement first arose in the early 2000s as a response to a accelerating deportation machine under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. But after the election of President Trump in 2016, religious congregations across the United States recognized that there was a need to not just accelerate the sanctuary movement, but to grow it on an astronomical level. And so the sanctuary movement had been bubbling before 2016, and beginning in early 2017, we saw congregations all across the United States once again kind of renew that pledge to be places of radical hospitality for those people who were fleeing or were afraid of detention, deportation. The difference between the 1980s movement, of course, is that many of the people who were walking into churches, into synagogues, were people who had called the United States home for many years. And so they were looking not just for safe harbor, but they were looking for a recognition that they were constitutive members of their communities. They were full neighbors in what it means to be the United States.
In our final moments together, how could people in Wisconsin provide better hospitality to immigrants moving here?
Well, I think it comes on many different levels. One is to disrupt this narrative that they are only newcomers and that they are foreigners who will only reside within the boundaries of our state for a limited time. We have to think of them as our potential future neighbors and think about all of the obligations that come along with that, not just being nice to someone, hospitable to someone, but thinking about what that means in terms of extending political, social, and economic power to these individuals as well. There are all of these different sites in which we can do that type of work. It's not just, of course, religious spaces, but we have to think about our obligations in terms of civic organizations, legislators, what they can do at the state level, not the local level, to adjust our laws to make sure that we have the full capacity to welcome people into the state of Wisconsin. So there's a lot that we can do.
Sergio, thank you for joining us and sharing your book.
Thank you, Kate. I really appreciate it.
Sergio Gonzalez, assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. The book is called Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.